I think at the heart of our problems in the US and here is this stretching apart that's occurred. When we were arguing these kind of things a few years ago, it was more difficult because you were talking about the rich getting richer, but people on average were getting a bit better off and so on. And a lot of people ignored these discussions. Now you have the average income of the average person in the country dropping. Income's dropping most at the bottom. And income's still rising just for the top 10%. But in fact, for people at the bottom of the top 10%, they're not rising. They're simply stable. But they're going up and up still at the top half of the top 10%, particularly for the top 1%. But you're getting an incredible churn that's going on. The people who are in the top 1% now are largely not the people who were in the top 1% 20 years ago. Let's click on again. There's something else that's very striking that's often talked about in terms of who's coming to London. This is concentrating on people coming to London at the very top of world society. People seeing London as one of the last safe havens for their money. So you have huge numbers of people, well not huge actually, it doesn't take many, but quite a lot of people with a lot of money buying property in the heart of London. This has now reached such an extreme that in Kensington and Chelsea, the number of people actually living there has dropped in the last 10 years. The rest of London is going up and up in population, but Kensington and Chelsea, where the average two-bed apartment is now well over a million, has actually seen a drop in population. Partly because you're getting smaller households moving in, partly because you're getting people simply buying property as an investment and leaving it empty. And you can kind of tell that things are going mad when that begins to happen. The other thing which is similar to the last crash, 1929 and the 30s, is that 1929 and the early 1930s is the last time that Britain had a recession or depression not accompanied by emigration. In the 1970s, when we had a little recession, more people left than came into the country. They went to New Zealand and Australia and so on, but more people left than came in. In the 1980s recession, with Freeman unemployed, more people left again than came in. They went to Germany, so we got Albert St. Pet. People went for work or to Holland. In the mini-1990s recession, in the early 1990s, more people left Britain than came in. But since this crash in 2008, more people have come into the country than have left. And that's strange, because normally what happens when you have an economic crash, less jobs to the young, less opportunities to people go. But when the crash is worldwide, where is there to go to? And also, when it's worldwide, you have all those people in the rest of Europe who are desperately trying to find some hope and somewhere to go. And Britain, or England, or South East England, I should say, offers hope, appears to offer hope to people. And if your second language is English, where would you go? It's new, but it's only new if you don't go back to 1929 and the early 30s to see it before. Let's click forward again. There aren't too many. You've been very patient. Here's an extreme one. Again, just making the point. This is who's affected by the cuts and how much is affected by the cuts. The cuts are very sly. Freezing benefits. Bringing in the bedroom tax. They're all salami sliced cuts. But when you put them all together, it becomes clear who is most affected. And also that there is a kind of plan out there, which is to gentrify London, which is to push out the poor, push out people on benefits, push them out as far as Newcastle or Cornwall or Stoke or Liverpool, and kind of keep riding an economic wave of this city. That appears to be what Plan A is. But it's not a particularly coherent plan. But it's certainly not occurring completely by accident. Let's click forward again. Okay, I've got 10 suggestions and then I'll stop. And these are fairly mainstream suggestions. I am a fairly boring university professor She can tell because she, poor thing, just listened to me for so long. In an ideal world, you'd completely change the system and sort yourselves out and have something completely new. And that does happen occasionally. But more often than not, and certainly when it's most likely to happen, is when you have an almighty crisis like now. But you can also get things improving in a way that's more gradual, but improving very quickly when you have a crisis. And that's what happened after 1929 in the 30s. In the 1930s, the income gap between the rich and the poor began to come down dramatically, and it carried on coming down in the 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s. So the gaps between us narrowed and narrowed and narrowed over time. It could happen again. Things I would suggest are worth doing or campaigning for. We need a better land and property tax than the council tax. The easiest way to do this isn't a mansion tax. What happens when you say you want to introduce a mansion tax is they wheel out some, normally an old lady, and say, this is terrible. It's not her fault her house is worth 2 million. She can't pay the tax, which is silly because anybody with a 2 million house is doing fine. But the way you solve this is you take the genius whoever introduced the council tax and ended it on band F, G and H or whatever, and a bit like Little Cat C out of Dr. Seuss, you introduce more council tax bans. At the moment, I walk past Kensington Palace Gardens, actually earlier today. Even the most expensive houses on Kensington Palace Gardens would only be council tax band N if you doubled. But you could have an incredibly high property tax for this property that's supposedly worth so much that people could pay or they could sell their property, and most people's council taxes could in effect be reduced. It's a way of getting towards a land value tax. And the whole point of a land value tax is to make it not worth people's while having property which is empty. You still give people the choice. If they want to pay an enormous amount of money in tax, they can have that right to do it, but you can use that money for something else. Second point, I haven't talked about this at all. In at least three of the countries in the UK, we have a thing which I call the right to sell. It's already in law. Northern Ireland is still arguing about it. And several hundred families have actually adopted the right to sell. What the right to sell is the right, if you're paying a mortgage, but you can no longer pay the mortgage, to stay in your house and to become a tenant. And in effect, to sell your house from the bank who owns it to a housing association or to the council. That right already exists. It's already in law. It was done by the last government, but the take-up was very low. If you're thinking, what do we do if the crisis gets worse? One opportunity is simply to take those laws that already exist and make them more workable, give people greater rights, and allow people to switch between people trying to buy their house on an interest-only mortgage or another mortgage that, unless everything goes well for them, they're never going to pay off, and become tenants, not have to move, kids carry on going to school and so on. If you do that, the difference between being a tenant and being a buyer and being an owner reduces. And the main thing which holds property prices up in Britain, which is how far is your house from the nearest council estate, that is reduced because your next door neighbours can become council tenants. This happened in the 70s. The council bought property then. Thirdly, I suspect nobody here, it would be interesting if somebody objects to this, but second homes, third homes, fourth homes in particular, holiday homes, empty commercial property. The great thing about property and land is it's sitting there, you can't hide it. There are ways in which you can encourage people not to leave it empty. My reason for going on about taxation so much is the fact that we are in this almighty economic calamity. So if you're going to raise money from somebody, there are people with a lot of money to raise it from, and you can raise it from them through their property, and you can encourage them to let people use their property. Let's click forward. I said there's 10 in total. Spare bedrooms. I'm a census nerd. The last census, which could be, the government plans for there not to be any more censuses, so it could be the last one forever. The 2011 census was the first census to count bedrooms in this country. Every bedroom, that is a room currently used as a bedroom, has been counted now, so we know where they are. These aren't rooms that could be used as a bedroom, they're rooms that are used as a bedroom with a bed in it. There are more bedrooms in inner London, according to the census, than there are people. Even if none of you in London ever wanted to share your bed with somebody else, if you all wanted your own bed, there is enough rooms with beds in them in residential property, it's not hotels or hostels, for everybody to have a bed. And that's just in inner London. In the country as a whole, there's about 2 bedrooms for every person currently. We have enough bedrooms. In the last 10 years, we've built more bedrooms than at any time that we can count between these decadal counts of rooms. These are rooms we built more. But they've largely been extensions. A 4th room put on top of a garage to a 3-bedroom house. But we've had a housing boom. It's just it's been extended property. So the rooms are actually there. But you've got increasing numbers of people, particularly elderly, affluent people, rattling around in this property. And they're partly rattling around in it, not because they want to, because they've got to pay to heat it, because they're concerned about their children's future, and they're trying to hold on to some kind of housing equity to give their kids a chance. So it's collective madness. Individually it makes sense, collectively it's madness. The middle point. People often say you need to build more houses, we need to build more houses. At one level I disagree from this, because we have so much. I worry that if we simply build more housing, given the way we've currently organised things, then people like David Cameron will just get to own 5, 6 or 7 houses. You need to alter how things are organised. We will need to build more houses if we continue to get more people in the way that we are, if immigration continues as it are, which I would be perfectly happy with, as somebody is going to need to have a catheter inserted in him if I'm lucky in about 40 years' time. I want there to be somebody to actually insert the catheter in me. So I'd like there to be increased immigration to Britain and more houses built. But for the population we've currently got at the moment, even in London, we actually have enough housing. The point down here, the gaps between us are growing, and economic gaps are growing, and this creates a problem. Salaries at the very top are still going up. Salaries on average are not going down as much as wages, people paid every week rather than every month. Benefits are going down in real terms. You need all these things to concertina together to have a more sensible housing system. And you need rents to fall. Rent levels, as I'm finding out in my mid-40s, and about to become a renter again. And I know I should have known, given that I researched this stuff, but it brings it home when you've actually got to do it. I'll be paying twice as much in rent if I manage to sell the house I'm trying to sell in Sheffield than as a mortgage. Right. Why am I paying twice as much in rent? Is it because the landlord is having to pay a lot of money to own that property? No, it's because the landlord sees that property as a source of income to get rich, to guarantee their retirement in a country that's becoming more and more unequal, where if you don't look after yourself and sting that university professor for as much rent as you can get him to pay, you could be in trouble. And this is what I mean about some form of solidarity right across the spectrum. Let's click forward to the last symptom. Rent controls does seem obvious. One problem that landlords have, if you're going to be slightly sympathetic to landlords, is that if you try to be a good landlord, that is, decorate the place, don't charge too much rent and so on, but for some reason don't manage to rent it out at certain times, another nasty landlord will simply come along and say, look, I'll buy that property off you, and the headache goes away. Rent controls reduce the encouragement for particularly nasty landlords to be landlords. Squatting clearly shouldn't be criminalised. Anything that anybody does simply to try to provide themselves with shelter, at the most, it's an act of civil disobedience. It should go through the civil courts. Criminalising is simply costly, stupid, counterproductive. But I would, and I'm generally a hippie, so I'm in favour of not criminalising people, and we put more people in prison in this country than anywhere else in Europe does. But if you look at some practices in London now, people renting out garden sheds to people, people renting out the utility room to a family, in parts of London. I honestly think, although rent controls would help, what would really encourage landlords not to do that kind of illegal activity would be if they did face the chance of being imprisoned, if they were exploiting people for their need for shelter that much. And I just think it's worth tipping those two things around and saying somebody making an awful amount of money speculating about other people's desperate need to be housed maybe should be seen as a criminal offence because of the effects it has on people. I haven't talked about health. I'll just talk very briefly about health. In 2008, life expectancy in the United States dropped for the first time since at least the 1930s. The drop in life expectancy in the United States coincided with these millions of families becoming insecure. It actually damages people's health, worrying and being concerned about housing. The group who are most damaged in their health are the very opposite group to you. And until I saw the figures, I didn't believe this. I thought the group we would first see having their health damaged in Britain from the crash would be young. I thought we'd see increased overdoses, increased suicides, increased accidents and so on. But one group in society has had an absolute increase in their rate of death. And these are women aged over 85. And currently, for the last 18 months, about 1,000 extra fairly elderly women have been dying in Britain every week as compared to the numbers that were dying before the last 18 months. What's going on? There are lots of theories. The one thing we know for sure is that we have this big increase in mortality amongst the elderly, faster than they should be dying. They're dying at 85, 86, rather than 1991. It's possible that a lot of elderly women have come in from Spain, because things are so bad in Spain, where people are tired too. But it's odd it's not the men. The big difference between men and women at these ages is the men tend to be lucky enough to carry on being with a woman and they die first, because men die 5 years earlier. So this is largely single women. It could be a virus. There's going to be reports in the newspapers, I think next week, about the potential for a virus that's come around that's done this. But the other thing that's happened to elderly women is their housing's become increasingly insecure. Care homes have gone bust. Southern Cross was the biggest one. Now, people didn't end up being evicted from that, but they thought they were going to be. And that sense of housing insecurity, the sense that that very basic thing, that all you're really left with at that point in life is going to be insecure, may be having an effect. And again, if you're trying to widen the sense of social solidarity, if this is the case, if we're actually seeing the rise in mortality amongst the elderly in Britain, to an extent that possibly, I'm being careful because it may not happen, but possibly will result in a year's time in the official life expectancy of this country actually coming down slightly for the first time since the 1930s. If that's occurring, it's partly because of the mess we make about our housing, then groups that campaign about housing need to spread out their message to the very elderly, particularly if you want to get more support, because almost everybody hopes to become old. They hope to at least get into their 70s, maybe into their 80s. They might think they're doing okay now, owning a property on the edge of London, but what kind of society are they going to grow up old in if it carries on like this? There's a report last week of a woman who died in Britain, and she died because the border agency raided the care staff who were looking after and feeding her and detained them because they were illegal immigrants. So nobody went and fed that woman that week, and so she died. These kind of things, you can see the connections between various policies. And last of all, which I failed to mention, but I should have mentioned early on, if you're worried at all about the environment and what's happening to the environment and what people do, then you want people to be efficiently housed in the housing stock you've already built. You want people to be housed near to where there are jobs, not to be commuting in, spewing out petrol from miles away. You want a housing system that encourages people to cycle to where they need to get to, which means they need to be able to be housed near the places they want to be. I think I've got one last slide, and then please tell me where I'm going wrong. Yeah, this could be the last one. Housing built for people working in industry in Sheffield well over 100 years ago, still standing today. It's a fairly sort of boring slide to end on, but if you think about the effort it took to get that kind of housing, first of all, provided, and then provided by the state, because it turned out charities weren't very good at doing it, and then the quality brought up the standard, and then trying to stop people knocking it down, but doing cleverer things like knocking two properties into one, rather than knocking it down. I think you can see that it's possible from what we did in the past to do things sensibly again in the future. But I honestly believe you need to connect it all together from the anxiety of the middle class through to what's happening to people in old age, through to young people who can't see how they can rent in a London market where rental prices are now looking the same as hotel bills. And last thing I'll say, you can just see the skylight in the distance there. All that conversion of lofts, all those extra bedrooms that have been put on houses, that's all been done. We have quietly been building houses. It's just been in the private sector, and it's also been building houses within houses. I think what you need to do is to work out how to encourage people, not in the social rented sector for the bedroom tax, but in that part of the sector with the most empty rooms, which is the private sector, how to encourage people to better fit together in what's already been built, so that we don't have a situation where this is the part of people's lives which does make them more fearful, despite the fact that we've actually already built the properties that we need. Thank you very much for your attention.